December 10, 2011, is the Watford Pedro Show.
Thank you.
Yeah, a lot of noise from our guests.
Crazy. It's going to be a crazy day.
First, I should tell you.
Yahoo.
What we started with, John Coltrane doing In a Sentimental Mood with Duke Ellington. And then after that, we heard Machica Do from Sawako. And, our guest brother Matt, Cole Panner.
Hello, Nicole.
From the desert.
Hey.
From the desert.
J-Tree.
Hey.
And Skipper Jeff is here.
Yourself, and Skipper Jeff has joined us also.
How's life in J-Tree these days?
I haven't been there for a little while. I'm not sure.
Nice. Actually, not from there, but that's where she's been living a while.
Where you've been hanging?
But you've been house-sitting. Well, I don't want to get ahead of the story.
Yeah, no personal life here.
I want to get ahead of the story for people who might not know.
My bad.
Nicole, how would you describe yourself?
I am a school marm. Spinster school marm from the desert is how I would describe myself these days. How would you describe me?
Wow. I was answering the questions.
Sometimes things can change in an
instant. I don't know. I thought you were part of the art field. No?
You've known me a long time. Yeah. What do you know?
Well.
Tell them.
I want you to tell. Start at the beginning, how you got on the road to being a school marm spinster.
I taught myself to read when I was 3. I was the child of a poor sharecropper. Not really. Isn't that how the jerk starts?
So there must be some farming out there.
There was. When I was a kid, right outside, that is where the first United Farm Workers contract was signed, just outside of Palm Springs.
Cesar Chavez country?
Cesar Chavez. It was great country. I can put Madonna and Cesar Chavez within a proximity of 2.
Wow.
Yes. The first grape grower to sign with the United Farm Workers was a man named Lionel Steinberg. He had a son named Billy Steinberg, who became Billy Thermal, who wrote Like a Virgin. Bada bing.
And Like a Virgin video was filmed right off the street at the church at Fort MacArthur.
Well.
Get to full circle.
I think that was like a prayer.
Oh, one of those. We're close.
Like us.
We're in the ballpark. Like a something or other.
Yeah. So.
Like a magic guy. I know Palm Spring uses a lot of water, though, because of them golf courses.
Yeah.
Well, there weren't. When I was a little kid, it was a small town.
They were using it for grapes.
That was outside of town. That was in, further down the valley, the Coachella Valley. No, Palm Springs was small when I was a kid. There were 7,000 people. And now it's gigantic, and all those little towns are connected.
Yeah.
And there's... I remember when they built the first shopping mall there, and it was like 3 stores. And the Graduate, there were 2 theaters in town, and the Graduate, when I was a little kid, played for 3 years.
Right downtown
at the Village Theater.
When did it turn into an old
Indian
people retirement thing?
Well, it was a rich people retirement thing, and it was a bad place for kids.
I just said old people. You could hike free before it was.
People are usually older when they retire.
No, rich people.
That's not the case. It must have been the time when it was kind of like Pioneer Town or something.
No, it was old rich people. I mean, I grew up with kids of movie stars. Yeah, it's where movie stars played.
What about before movies?
No, not when I was a kid. What are you talking
about? Yeah, I know. I thought
I was
going back before your history.
Oh.
Because since I've been in Cal, I came here in 68, 67, and Palm Springs always been known as an old people retirement.
Yeah,
with money.
Snowbirds.
No, it was like higher end than that. Snowbirds were down in Cathedral City, which is where the pot dealers were too. But yeah, my family, my stepdad was Pat the King of Steaks, the Philadelphia Cheesesteak King.
Oh.
My mother was his who knows how manyth wife. She was quite a few decades younger than him. And he retired to Palm Springs with his new young family, which was us.
That's why I think the golf course is probably got put in, was for these retired people.
Well, for rich people. Rich people play golf. Yeah. It's what they do.
Ghetto people do too.
What kind?
Not as rich.
Oh.
I know it's.
Yeah, rich people got time.
You know, one of their. Yeah. Especially if they make the game so expensive, only certain people can play. But like Harvard College, right? I mean, there's.
Yeah. But a lot of this.
Nick Aguilar's pop, Rudy's big into golf, and he's a longshoreman.
Oh.
Yeah, they got some time.
And they got union money, union wages money. The last of.
Yeah, get off early, go hit the
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't from the culture. I think they just wanted to play. I think with the rich people, they make their deals and stuff.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it.
That's why I think they want it kind of a little exclusive.
Wasn't a lot of it health related? Going out there, people asthmatic and to get their
drink. The desert's always been that.
For retirement.
Yeah.
Well, warm weather. I mean, it's easier to grow older if your weather is copacetic.
Yeah, the air's better. Yeah, joints cold is, I know, because it's really hard.
Yeah.
Wet, cold especially, so a dry thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, okay, so you started in Palm Springs.
Yeah, and
were you thinking of teaching then, way back when you were a girl?
No, I thought I wanted to be, well, I knew I wanted to have adventures. Whoops, whoa. Somebody's at the door. This is like the Soupy Sales show.
Yeah, old-time Dean Martin.
Okay, who's here now?
And just a collection of stars.
Okay, you wanted to have adventures.
Yeah. I wanted to have adventures and, have a fun and interesting...
Cork in it, Skipper Jeff.
Yeah, Skipper Jeff, this is my time. We're going to have to put you out the door.
Excuse me. Just delivery boy here.
Are we through? Settle everybody.
We're good.
Mike and I are all about business here.
Sorry.
So what were you asking me?
When you were young, you weren't thinking of a teacher. You were thinking
of adventures. Yeah. And I was, a weird little smart kid and... who was kind of misfit in this town full of
kids. You learned how to read it.
Three.
Nice.
By reading the comics, looking at the pictures,
That's great.
Well, and I went to Quaker school, and they really are serious about teaching people. Quaker school? Well, pretty much soon after that, they sent me away to school.
You were kind of a misfit in school.
Well, I was a misfit in Palm Springs.
In Palm Springs.
And in my family.
Okay.
I was the blonde... blue-eyed one in a family of very dark peoples. So I kind of thought there was a little alien changeling experiment. It turned out that my father was really my stepfather instead.
Oh.
Yeah. But, that never occurred to me. Being imaginative, I thought it was alien.
Yeah, mystery solved.
Yeah. So, my biology never seemed to really mesh with theirs. Nah, she's
messed
like...
up with the alien theory.
So the alien
she
thing...
She had to deliver you. Oh, you could have been implanted. Oh.
Or just a changeling, just like,
okay.
Changeling who was put with these people and they somehow had agreed.
He was sent to educate them.
Yeah. No. Sent to just be observed, by... force is greater than yourself. I started to hitchhike into L.A. to go to music shows. From Palm Springs, yeah. It was, back in the 70s when hitchhiking, if you were a girl, was easy. And, it wasn't until somebody did something untoward that I finally went, whoa, I can't really do this anymore. But there was a good long run there when I would read Cream Magazine and read about the Continental Hyatt House and Rodney's English Disco and the Sugar Shack. So I'd hitchhike into town and go to those places.
There's no gigs in Palm Springs.
Well, the few gigs there were really weird, and it was when, being a stuffy old person's town, all of a sudden there were hippies, and some promoter got the bright idea to do Canned Heat and Lee Michaels at the local rodeo grounds, which of course ended up in a rock and bottle throwing melee with the police, And I was sort of going into the city more and more, and I saw, I had the good luck to see...
Hold on, let's play some music.
We can lie so perfect. Got a body line to every car. It's a very short...
Watt from Pedro show. We start that off with the Germs doing What We Do Is Secret. Then we heard some old television with What I Heard. Then What You Say, something live from the Ludes. That's L-O-O-D-S, not the other kind, 70s kind spelling. And then Jello Biafra and the Guantanamo School of Medicine. Something brand new called The Cells That Will Not Die. I saw Jello in San Francisco just a couple days ago.
Oh, Greg Turner said to say hi, and you ripped the other night.
Greg went there. Yeah, yeah, I was going to talk about him later because I got a song by one of his bands. And then on College Kids and Gang Signs by Amateur. And finally, Go Team Go by Sporadic Spontaneous. I wanted to get some tunes in there. I didn't mean to interrupt you. But okay, here you were in Palm Springs and there wasn't a lot to do except foul some Indian facilities.
I never did.
Law enforcement, kind of easy work. They left the door open for you.
Yep.
You didn't have to take the sticks out.
No. There was no rock and
roll. You would
bottle.
Learn that later yes. in SoCal, though. And, yeah, so you start hitchhiking into town,
and I ended
now
up.
You said Rodney's English Disco, so this is telling me, because you read it in
Cream.
So maybe Greg Turner was writing in it.
I don't
or
think
Metal Mike or Meltzer and Bangs.
Meltzer and Lester were.
And then I think Lisa Robinson in New York.
And Lisa Robinson.
I remember
was.
Reading this stuff. That's the only way I could learn about things.
Me too.
And I weren't all jive like Rolling Stone or what was the other one?
KHJ Radio.
No, Hit Parade.
Hit Parade, yeah, but there right? was also.
Circus.
Circus, yeah, and there was terrible. Crawdaddy was there.
Well, a little bit, yeah, yeah. I remember them.
Yeah, but.
They kind of. They didn't last long. Meltzer wrote in them too.
Yeah. For me, though, it was Cream Magazine.
Yeah, me too.
That was like.
That's where we learned out about a bunch of stuff. That's how we learned of Stooges, actually.
Yeah, me too, and Patti Smith. You
know, even though they were playing at that time up in Hollywood, we didn't know here in Pedro. We're about 30 miles. So you might have known more than us being way out in the desert there.
Well, I wanted to meet Led Zeppelin at the Continental Hyatt House. Or the Sugar Shack, or Rodney's, which I never did.
I never went to a club. I only went to Arena Rock. I didn't know until punk about clubs.
And, you know, I'd never been to Arena Rock at all. The first Arena Rock show I went to was when Pat Smear played that show with Nirvana at the Forum. That was the first time I ever went to a big show, like arena show. But a really important show when I was hitchhiking into town that a lot of people who I would later come to meet was David Bowie Diamond Dogs at the Greek Theater. Or it's the Universal. The Universal Amphitheater. It was one of those that was outdoors.
They didn't have the roof on it yet. Yeah.
And
so that was a kind of arena rock show.
Yeah, arena to me is like
it's not a club though.
It's not a club.
Okay. For us the smallest was the Long Beach Auditorium or the Santa Monica Civic. They hold like 3,000.
Yeah,
but compared to a club. I had never been in a club, and so that's why I call it that.
Yeah.
It's not Enormadome.
No, it's not Enormadome. I'd never been to an Enormadome show, let's just say that.
But or just sitting in the dark in seats, you know, different than a club where you're actually talking to people. And,
but that Bowie show was different. It was very, it had sets, it had costumes, it had like a narrative through line. It was.
What was the narrative? Oh,
it was Diamond Dogs. It was
1984. Some kind of the end of the world.
Yeah, and there were sort of spurting volcanoes all over the stage. It was.
Oh, and I know he did a lot of costume changes.
Yes.
Paper.
Yeah.
Suits they tear off.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I started.
You start meeting people at these gigs, right?
I don't know that I did. That's not my memory. My memory is somewhere.
Well, you weren't bringing people in from the desert. You were coming.
No,
in by
I was
yourself.
Coming in by myself. And I somehow got a hold of a copy of Backdoor Man. And I met those people. I met Audrey and
you
Greg.
You got a copy and I want to meet these people?
Well, I got a copy and
from
I
them?
Think I met them somewhere.
Oh,
and
gig?
Was like, oh, you're. Yeah. And so.
Freddie and Dee Dee.
Freddie and Dee Dee and Audrey.
Audrey.
And Greg.
Right.
Who Freddie's still a
Who's
friend.
Who's the other one? Waller?
Don Waller. Don Waller.
He was on the show a couple of years ago. Remember, okay. Brother Matt?
Yeah, yeah.
Great stories.
Yeah, yeah.
He took a lot of blows. So I've eaten the a lot of shit in the band. Think that man. Man, is he?
OG status. Paving the way.
Good cat. So you met, for those people listening don't know, this was a early... They ain't punk yet, but it's kind of getting ready for
it. Right on the cusp, yeah. And through Greg, I met Ron Spencer. Ron and I formed a record company, and our secret silent... With Peter Paterno, who went on to become, like, a big music industry lawyer. And our secret money guy, meaning he helped us get records pressed on Warner Brothers' dime, was Bob Merlis, who became the man who invented Madonna, basically. He was the man behind the curtain.
Yeah, but wait a minute. Uh-huh. You're going to gigs, and all of a sudden you have and you meet some guys from fanzine, and then you have a company.
And then Ron and I, and we put
what
out.
What was in between? There's no
friendship.
No, but what gave you the? Was it your idea to make the company?
No, it was all of ours together. It was like, let's press a record.
Let's make a record.
Yeah, and it was the bomb
record. Our favorite
record.
Band, but
only limited no, it by was your like, imagination.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
Not your favorite band.
No, not my favorite band. Just one that was within.
That you knew.
Arm's reach.
Okay.
So we put out...
Because you weren't doing music. You were just a
I was just a around. I was a witness.
Witness.
And,
I mean, yeah, they're important.
A girl about
town. You can't
town.
Have just people making music a lot of times. You need to be...
Yeah. I mean, I knew I was going to be some kind of artist or live an arty life.
Oh, okay.
I knew I was going to live an arty life.
Okay.
That was the deal.
And these people interested you.
Yeah. These people... Well, I mean...
You know, from my own experiences, I remember meeting these people, and they blew my mind.
Yeah.
You know, I never met people like the punk people in the 70s. Because I hadn't really been to Hollywood or anything, so these people, when I met them...
What year was it
when you met
them?
It was a lot different
than... Do you remember?
I graduated high school in 76, and there was a guy, Nicky Beat, lived here. He's from Pedro.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, that's how we found out there was gigs.
Oh, okay.
He was walking where these boats are now in the marina. It used to be the lower reservation of Fort MacArthur. And they were renting these things out because there was plans to tear them down and do that. So in the meantime, Mark Weisswasser, buddy of ours, me and D-Boom would jam with. We were down there copying songs off records like we did, like idiots. And he's walking there with a Kotex around his neck. It's a place where people wrote their own songs.
Uh-huh.
Because no one we knew did that. You just copied records and... He said he was in this band, and they were having gigs in the afternoon on Sundays at the Whiskey.
Yeah.
And so that's, we started seeing these gigs.
Yeah.
And meeting these people. And Nicky was kind of like Pedro guy.
I didn't know that. I had no
idea.
Well,
I do.
He seems so. He seems
I know
like,
Pedro guys.
Doesn't like
but
Pedro,
he was to us, not as... You know, he's a trippy cat and great drummer, but he wasn't like as different as.
Yeah, you got to go out of town for that stuff.
I know even though he dressed a wild and stuff, it was you could tell he was Pedro. I still, if I see him, there's ways we can tell each other.
Yeah,
Pedro. Even though I'm not from here, well, we do, and these people were just different, you know. And my whole world from Virginia was Pedro, so I. It was a mind blow for me. So maybe for you too, coming from Palm Springs and meeting him. Maybe this is why you wanted to do a label, why you want to get involved with him right away.
Yeah,
well, it was
because
it was
just
it was something I could do. It was a way I could contribute because the whole thing was do it yourself. What can you do? And people were shortly after that would start producing their own books and do poetry readings and all of that stuff. And I was too shy to do any of that. I didn't think I could do it. I wasn't encouraged at home to express myself in any way, shape, or form. In fact, I was discouraged from it. My home life was really sort of violent and, you know, I couldn't get out of there fast enough.
What about school?
A school was kind of like these people are fucking idiots.
Did you go to college?
I graduated 3 years before you're supposed to.
Wow.
Because I told them I was going to drop out, and this is before GEDs, and they're like, no, you can't drop out. And I'm like, watch me. Make me go to school, because I'm not going to go anymore, because this is awful. So we came up with a thing, and if I could get the credits, and I did that by going to junior college at the same time I was going to high school, their high school. So I doubled up on credits, and I went to school from 7 in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon, and then I had night classes 7 nights a week. So I managed with the skipping and everything to get out of there early. And then I just went to L.A. more and more and more, and finally I found a place to live. It was $50 a month. It was an apartment on Beechwood Drive, north of Franklin.
I know where that is. That's Hollywood.
Yeah, just yeah. One of those ponies. You can ride horses into the
up at the top. Yeah.
Paul Rossler lived around there.
Well, Paul lived four doors down from us. Paul and Kieran, Helen, and Trudy and KK. Once after they left the Canterbury, went to the Wilton Hilton. The haunted place on Wilton, and then an apartment opened up in our little fourplex. And by then, I believe it was $75 or $100 a month.
Still pretty good.
Yeah.
That was a good zone.
But it was a nice, like, Spanish-y apartment. You know, and the landlord was this crazy Serbian guy who wore paper bags on his head.
Dobro.
Yeah. So.
Paper bags. That's what they were wearing when I saw them first.
Who?
In the bags.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, this was
an unknown comic stole it.
Yeah.
The El Duce thing.
So it was,
it was a punk.
A little sort of enclave of sympathetic people. But before all that was like the Canterbury, which I've never been much of a group person, so I never wanted to move into the Canterbury and be part of that.
Well, you were talking this backdoor people. They actually weren't so much like that. Dee Dee was Carson, I think.
Yeah.
A lot of them didn't live this lifestyle. They were just fans of the music and wanted to.
Well, I transitioned from the back doorman to harder core
to the mass
stuff
people.
That was going to the mass people and to the slash people. Claude, Bessie, and Philomena became very influential. They were like my parents,
Bessie was a kick boy and had this magazine called Slash, which was pretty intense for a reading material for a scene that little.
Yeah.
There's like 200 people, and this scene was like, I mean, this zine was very thick and knowledgeable about writing. That's where I first read Jeffrey Lee, writing his Ranking Jeffrey Lee.
Ranking Jeffrey Lee,
all these cats. it was a real fabric to the cultures.
Well, and Claude was like an
incredible... Yeah, but I only saw these people at gigs, you know, so I didn't know them as real people.
But he was
seemed
like
to me as like real... people, that scene was so open and stuff, I never got shut out.
I
used to rap with this guy.
Yeah.
He didn't know him except for punk shows. This is all I knew him, but very kind. A lot of those cats were Gerardo
also,
and Nervous Gender, all these cats, they seemed like from an alien thing, and there was no heirs.
Yeah, and the thing about Claude that was so amazing, and those people, they were a little bit older, but they were... fiercely self-educating. They were just thirsty for knowledge. At the same time, I was putting myself through UCLA because I thought I have this high school degree. I might as well. It's like doing high school for real. So at the same time, I got my bachelor's at UCLA in something stupid, you know, something I didn't care about. But my real education was taking place amongst all these people who were... they wanted to know about everything. I mean, we would go to clubs in South Central to see music I'd never heard of.
So you were going to school and going to gigs, hanging out with these people.
Yeah. Falling in love with some of them.
What happened with the label?
We put out the Vom record. And then Ron Spencer ended up taking those pictures of the germs for me that are those kind of iconic images. Still one of my closest friends in the world. He and Turner both. They live in Santa Fe.
You guys released one record.
Well, and then we decided, we looked around, and somehow the Avengers occurred to us.
Oh, right, because...
The American in me. But that became a really complicated deal because... a couple of them were very difficult. And suddenly, we just wanted to put out beautiful objects into the world. Ron was a graphic designer. We all loved records. We all loved this music. My first favorite bands were the Screamers and the Weirdos. And by then I was already managing the Germs by the time our second record came out. But it was, it took...
I was going to get to that.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Just knowing people.
Well, I wanted to be more...
Let's play some music.
Okay.
Thank you.
Essential Logic, not the band, but a song from, I think, 1994, by Ruins and Kazutoki Umezu. Before that, Mute Whale by Light, Tokyo Brothers. And we start off with Indigo Road, Wakine, something live from them. I haven't played them in a while. I love that band. We're at the end of the first hour of December 10, 2011, Watt for Pedro Show. Hold tight for hour two. December 10th, 2011, the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show. Pedro Show. Start off the second hour with somebody who opened up these Three Stooges California gigs that I was part of this past few days. Les Butcherettes, Terry Genderbender. I was telling Nicole here, because you wanted to go.
I did.
You could have gone. Somebody had tickets.
Somebody offered me tickets. Steve Desjardins.
Yeah, school late.
I had to teach.
Anyway, this is Dress Off, this song. They're a great band. If you folks get a chance, you got to check them out. Had to teach. Because I keep till 11 or something, right?
Yeah.
God damn.
I know.
But I understood. Then we heard A Dressing Failure by Omar Rodriguez Lopez, who was playing bass for her. Omar, I turned him on. I wonder how old he is. But I turned him on to psyllium husks.
So he could poop? Is that a band?
That's part of it, but it's also fiber, and it don't always have to be a laxative. It's good for cleaning. Yeah, it's good for old, less younger people.
Is he a less younger person?
No, he ain't, but he might be coming on to the beginning of that threshold or something. I was just thinking, you know what, I could do him right by just giving him one of these packages. I don't know how we got to talking about it. He was into it.
Okay, I was just making sure it wasn't a band I don't know about, psyllium husks.
No, it's kind of a
droga.
Just the sheath of a grass.
Yeah, yeah.
But man, is it a good thing?
Effective.
Well, you know, in the old days, there was probably enough fiber in our diets, you know, but we've obliterated that. So
when you travel a lot,
it's kind of a salad. Yeah, but even in Pedro, I take it. I do my own cooking. Oh, anyway, not to get on tangent. I also saw in San Francisco my buddies from Saco, Taramelos. Nick Reinhardt, his bass man Nathan, and so we heard some of that. Is good for what ails you, and then finally Window Shop by Boris. Now, yeah, we gotta. Is this kind of an infamous thing for you, talking about being Germ's manager?
Why? I did a good job and.
No, infamous. Like when people want to meet you, they know about this, and is this like the big?
Well, men want to date me because of that.
Because of the Germ.
That makes it an automatic no.
That's why I was kind of saying.
Yeah.
I heard of you.
It makes no.
Just like some guy. Because to me, this other stuff too, knowing Kickboy, being part of that label, Backdoor Man, those things are very important too. But I know because the infamy, in fact, we just came up on the anniversary a few days ago of
Darby's self.
You know what's trippy about that? Like, he was a young man.
He was 22.
22 years old, okay? I was the same age. And when I think back of a 22-year-old, I think of a very young man.
Yeah.
But it's weird. When I think of him, I don't think of him as a young man. He kind of, this happens with D. Boone, too. Like, they age with me.
Yeah.
Because they stopped at with me at an age.
Yeah.
And so my memory, it's weird. I don't think of them as young guys. If I was had more perspective and more objective perspective, I would think these were very young men.
Yes, this year, D. Boone been was 27. Dead as many years has he been dead? Something about, right about?
84.
It's crazy.
Was it 84?
It was a long time.
Yeah. See, I have kind of a different theory. I will always think of Darby as a baby, pretty much.
I know him as baby, but
well, a 22.
He was this cat that was very trippy.
But he was also like not a manly 22. He was a very teenage 22.
He was. I mean, towards the end, he didn't look so good.
I know.
But
I know,
before that, when they were doing the album,
yeah,
he. Oh my God.
Yeah,
very,
but he looked
very
like
good looking man.
A little boy to me.
I mean, he had kind of a little boy face.
Years in those
22, but he was in good shape. You know, the band was in good shape.
Yeah.
And then when he came back, this is when we opened up for Black Flag, and he came to the gig with this mohawk, and he was all puffy and much different looking than this.
Yeah, he came to my door. I took a Polaroid. I have a Polaroid of him.
Came in that thing.
Yeah, he came in. I was on roller skates. And
he told us about
Adam Ant.
That's right.
Yeah. And I was like, what, are you fucking kidding me?
We didn't know.
Adam
we never heard. And Darby, we would think, would know. You know, and he had been just been there. And,
yeah.
But anyway, let's get back to your story. How did this happen?
It just did.
Because the Canterbury people?
No. I think by then...
He's good friends of Paul's.
He's good friends of Paul's. Down. They went to high school together.
Right.
I don't think Paul moved there until after, though, I was managing them already.
Oh, okay.
It just kind of happened. I decided that I wanted to be more than a bystander, and I was organized, you know, because I'd been responsible for my own survival.
Yeah, they hadn't had one before.
They hadn't had a manager. They were, at that point, banned from every club in town because they would encourage their fans to break shit, yeah. And I just said, well, I think I can help you. I can at least make sure that we're paid for things, that you're paid for shows and that you get shows. And I'm going to... I made up GI. GI meant Germs Incognito. I said,
secret name so they could get gigs.
Yeah. And...
good idea.
You know, it was kind of easy peasy. I set up a publishing company which still has paid out hundreds of thousands of dollars to the songwriters and their heirs with Bug Music. You know, I did right by them. I don't think I ever made anything. I got a handful of... I don't know. I was sort of Florence Nightingale. It was my own fault. I could have paid myself if I wanted to.
Well, in those days, you say there's money for publishing, but that's more recent days. It wasn't back in those old days.
Yeah, but you know what, Mike?
No.
We would not play for less than $1,000. Those four people walked away with every show that I booked with $250 in their pocket.
Every gig.
And if
I saw them at some little ass places. I can't believe.
I got guarantees and paid in advance.
Good job.
I got guarantees and paid
for $4 days, doors.
I got guarantees and paid in advance.
Job.
And we wouldn't go on stage.
Do you remember the gig there when X was playing at the Long Beach Arena with Devo? It was New Year's Eve, and it was like the big decision. Do you go see the Germs?
Well,
I think they were with Joanna Wendt.
Yeah.
Do you remember this
gig?
Yes,
I do.
And that's why I went to that one.
Me too.
Because everybody was saying, no, look, it's a breakthrough. We've made it. And nothing against X and Devo.
There was also that thing about, like, Darby didn't want to do the decline of Western civilization.
Yeah.
I'm like, why? And he's like, because people will think I want to be a rock star. There was those of us who were like, rock stars suck. Rock stars to us meant ELO and, you know, Rick Wakeman, who got the Sex Pistols kicked off of his label. And to some of us, X were like people who wanted to be rock stars. A friend of mine said, it's punk rock for hippies. And, you know, whatever, to pretend that split didn't exist would be kind of to lie to history.
Well, it seemed like that was like the decision day
or
night. I remember that.
Yeah.
It was like, well.
Yeah. So, you know, they did okay for themselves, the Germs, for a punk band that, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine. For those days. So...
So, yeah, I would
they
get...
just asked... No, you solicited them. Hey, can
I do
this
Darby
one?
And I were sitting on the curb at the music machine outside the gig. And I was like, why don't you have a manager? And he's like, because no one would want to manage us. And I was like, well, I do. And he was
that sounds like a solicited thing.
Yeah. And he was like, okay. And then that was it.
Yeah.
That was it until the April 1st show at the Whiskey.
Yeah.
Where my husband at the time had become Gary Panter, who was an artist, and there was an
Jimbo for you people out there.
There was an
used to be a strip that would be in
Slack and
that
books.
Was great, and then it ended up also in the Weekly
and
right
no, the Reader.
Reader,
and then Raw Magazine out of New York, which was like
right,
a slick.
Right.
Art Spiegelman, who did Mouse,
started
it, and he had his strips in there.
Right.
But there was an incident at the Whiskey where some kid in the audience had lit, in a crowded audience, up towards the front, lit a piece of paper on fire and was holding it up. And a bouncer came down to get it. Pat lifted his guitar up as if to clobber the bouncer, and I jumped in between the two and went, no, stop! And after that show, my husband said, either you quit or we're getting a divorce because I can't watch this anymore. You put yourself in danger.
And so, it was time to quit.
Yeah.
April 1st, 1980.
Yeah.
Now, as at the same time you were doing managing for the Germs, you were involved with People the Scene, which we were talking about before. A lot of artistic people were in this scene. This is actually before hardcore. And you didn't have as many young people like what later would come in a couple of years.
Yeah. Even though we were young, there were also older people. There were like,
but we were like 13 or 14 year olds, like hardcore became. High school people and stuff.
Yeah, no, we did have a few 14 year old runaways from Riverside show up.
Sure.
The
and
doorstep.
Who was that kid?
Donnie Rose.
Donnie Rose. Is he still around?
He passed away years and years ago.
Sweet kid.
Yeah.
But very rough. Mugger was kind of like that, a runaway.
And,
but that is different than the people in Orange County, you know, when that punk went there. It's a little different kind of scene.
It's way different because we were more like the Addams Family, that first generation of punk. You know, the Addams Family crossed with the Merry Pranksters.
Yeah.
Kind of.
So some hippie stuff.
It was the more prankster part of the Merry Pranksters.
Yeah, I know.
The good
humor.
One of
my theories about punk why it had to come was because the hippies had lost the humor, lost the prank stuff.
I would agree.
Yeah.
But then after, when those guys, the next hardcore people came in, that humor thing got really like.
Yeah, but you're dealing with really young people
out,
and a lot of peer pressure at school, and you can imagine.
Well, we had peer pressure at school too.
I was out of school when I was.
Yeah.
I didn't have to go to high school and be a punk rocker.
But I mean,
imagine how that.
People were still throwing shit at us. It was.
Oh, I know that.
Street.
I know about that.
Yeah. I mean, I remember.
That's why I went back to my high school clothes, basically, you know, because first couple of years I painted on, you know, I made my own clothes. And there was too much hell.
Yeah.
So I had to decide to just have it up here and not wear it.
Yeah.
Because these fuckers would waste all your energy. I wouldn't let anybody at work or at school know. I had to, like, have the, like, Kafka with the two desks. But what happened with Philip K. Dick?
Gary Panner was like my fifth boyfriend or husband in a row who was obsessed with Philip K. Dick. And I was like, okay, we're going to find him and you're going to talk to him. Seriously, that was what it was. And this was like way before the internet. I don't even know how I managed to do it, but I somehow got.
You like reading this guy, I want to meet him.
Yeah, because Gary was like, no, but he'd been like the fifth or sixth guy that I'd been. Johnny Stingray from the Controllers was obsessed with Philip K. Dick.
The boyfriends. Bass man.
Yeah, he was like my first punk rock boyfriend, but there were other ones.
He was Riverside or something?
No, he was from Detroit.
Oh, originally?
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Those guys
him
moved
and
out
Spike
here.
Moved out together. Yeah.
But he ended up, I think, in Riverside or something.
No, he's a very, I've heard, wealthy ex boiler room. Owner, phone. He went into phone sales. And apparently made a shitload of money.
Okay, maybe there was a little period. Somebody was telling me he made another band after Controllers.
Well, there was.
But anyway, off the tangent.
All these men that I was with wanted to talk to me about Philip K. Dick at the dinner table. I was like, I don't know who this is, but I'm going to find him, and you can talk to him.
You mean you don't want to read the books, you want to find the guy.
Because it was like, it was being sold as science fiction.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, I hate science fiction. I'm not a science fiction fan, you know. I like natural history. So, essays, Joan Didion.
Nonfiction.
Nonfiction. So I found Phil, who was living in a dingbat apartment in Santa Ana. And he was kind of agoraphobic. And
how old was he?
He was 50 when I found him, and which seemed ancient to me. Like an old guy. He was like an old guy.
He is an old guy.
And we arranged to go visit him, and Gary and him talked a little bit about books and stuff. And his friend K.W. Jeter was there, and K.W. knew who Gary and I were. And because KW knew about punk a little bit, KW was much younger. But Phil and I really hit it off. I mean, he had like an old man crush on me, you know.
Oh, he's an old?
He was an old man, and I was like,
not really,
you know,
he was middle-aged.
He was, to me, he was like ancient, and I
in
was...
2 weeks, I'm 54.
Right?
And you were how old?
And I was like 20 and a housewife and kind of unhappy, but super cute and like, you know, pale and Morticia-like. And, you know, he was like...
He was Gomez.
He was, he, yeah.
Or faster.
Yeah. More like, yeah. You know, and I didn't want to talk to him about, like, that year he went crazy, which is basically what it was, which he told me all about in his own time. I mean, we talked about that eventually because... We talked every day eventually for, like, years on the phone. And every 3 or 4 weeks, Gary and I would go, like, it's time to go down to Santa Ana and visit Phil. And we'd stop at Disneyland on the way and have, like, half a day at Disneyland.
Oh, Christ.
And I know, I know. No. Gary and I were both pretty drug and alcohol-free. Neither of us drank. He came from a... super Church of Christ background.
I appreciate Mickey way more on things.
Yeah.
But Phil had his runs with stuff.
No, Phil was, you know,
well,
kind
he used to write on stimulants.
But that had been years and years and years earlier. And, you know,
what about drinking?
No, I never saw any evidence of that either. And I used to go
into... Because that's always the plagues of writers, it seems.
Yeah, well, it's lonely to be a writer. Yeah, okay. You know, you're... isolated. And I would go into his fridge all the time. You know, I'd walk in the house and go into the fridge and go like, Jesus, Phil, you know, there's nothing in here. And KW would bring him food because he was a bit agoraphobic too. And then I remember when there was a day that Phil's bank account hit $100,000 because they bought the rights to Blade Runner. To androids.
Yeah. Androids.
And he said to me, Nicole, my bank account has $100,000 in it, and my favorite teller at the bank hit me up for money. What should I do? And I'm like, hello? No. And he ended up actually loaning her money. I ran into someone years later who, like, knew the ins and outs, a legal person. But he was, you know... a sweet old guy who was lonely and fucked up. Yeah. No, I'm just saying from my perspective as a 20-year-old suicidal housewife, you know.
Then you haven't ventured to the teaching thing yet.
No, because it won't happen until 1995.
Well, you got this degree. Yeah, you get this degree at
UCLA. I get this degree at UCLA.
But just let it flounder,
it
right?
Was anthropology. It was like a degree to travel on.
No, but sometimes you can get teaching off those kind of things.
Well, you have to...
I teach any cool excavations?
No,
and both
nothing.
My sisters are teachers. I'm into teachers. But that dude, stuff
you
can...
teach?
Yeah, he was...
How old?
Teacher...
16, 18.
Wow, okay, they would like you.
No, these are cats who quit school.
Yeah, continuation. I did a thing, thing at the continuation.
He's
downtown.
Gotten several Teacher of the Years. He has great success rates.
No, I bet. There's a thing downtown. In fact, the last time I saw Pat Smear's mother, I did this volunteer 8-week zine class at a hardcore continuation that's down near Grand Central Market in a senior citizen's high-rise. They have the day room. And all of this woman's, they're hardcore Salvadorian gangster boys and unwed mothers.
Belmont Zone, downtown, right in the
Yes. And she makes sure they all go on to continued education. I mean, it's kind of amazing. So we did a zine class there. And
that makes it work. Having a zine or something you can relate to makes education worthwhile, because otherwise it's just a bunch of bullshit.
Do you remember your
totally
zine?
Bullshit,
What's that?
Remember your zine?
I remember making my own shit up as long as
remember that zine? I put it up on my hood.
Right. The Chunklet.
He did this thing to get these cats motivated. The something like a zine is really good.
Well, I thought I was bombing for the whole 8 weeks. I'd volunteered to do this thing through the Heart Project, and they would just sit there and look at me. And at the end, when we did books, and everybody had a book, and they were like, this is like our yearbook. We don't have a yearbook. And it was all stuff they'd written. And they were like, this is the best class we've ever had. And I'm like, I wish you guys would have told me, because I thought we were bombing here. But anyway, they brought this woman down. They said, we have someone we want you to meet. It's Madame Ruther. And it was this older black woman. And it was Pat Smear's mom, and she lives in the senior thing, and she would volunteer to teach them French. because she had been an opera singer and stuff. Yeah. So that's the last time I saw her.
Education so much more real. Like we had Flea here, and Flea got his own school teaching
music. Yeah.
Conservatory.
And it just makes education so much real. Yeah. More real and gives it a purpose, because otherwise you just spend your time doing bullshit that doesn't relate to anything.
Yeah, textbook stuff, which they're never going to...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes it more real and gives it a purpose, so it gives it a reason to learn.
Yeah. It's more fun,
salute
too.
Salute to you.
Yeah. Well, you have to, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, otherwise... Like, why spend your time and effort and energy doing something that doesn't relate to you?
But what bent you this way from the suicide housewife who likes Philip K. Dick as a person, not a writer, into zines for Salvatore guys?
Make it real.
Well, I had a little dabble with showbiz. I got asked to work on the Pee Wee Herman show before it was a thing.
Oh, with Gary.
Yeah, we both, right. We were married, and we both had different phone numbers, and our phones rang, and we were asked to work on this thing that was going to be a play, and I ended up being in it, writing for it and being in it.
Yeah.
And
I used to hang out at Kicks, so you back in those old days?
Yeah.
You know, I saw him last spring.
Who, Paul? Oh.
At
that show?
It was one of these afternoon shows where they film you do some songs, and my opera, third opera goes come out, and he was the next guy after me.
Yeah. Well, so we did that at the Roxy. We did it first at the Groundlings, and at the Roxy is a live play. And everybody came. Robert
Groundlings
De Niro.
Groundlings was like Melrose, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we moved to the Roxy, and then we filmed it for HBO. It was
like
just
not
on
ready
the other
for
night.
Primetime Players LA style.
Pretty much, yeah. And then it was on HBO just the other night. So then I decided, I got an offer to be in a film, and I was like, I don't know how to act. I'm going to go study. So I went and studied with this lady named Peggy Fury for years until she died. Every day, 4 days a week. But then Gary and I got divorced. I ran off to England with a rock star. I stayed in Europe for 5 years, and I was in India for a year of that. I had a show of my own briefly in England on TV. And then I came back to L.A. because I'm a Californian. You know, you can't be away from here forever.
Don't you think everyone should bring a rock star and move to England for a few years, though?
I would say that it would qualify
as an adventure. Well, you talking about that rock star for hippies.
You what?
What band was that?
I know your priorities changed, though, right?
You know what? Brother Matt's got a spin cycle we got to do.
Yo. Well,
very interesting story, though, but we'll pick up one more.
Sure.
Okay, we're just winging it.
a genuine boy.
Thank you.
gonna make a wee wee.
Inspiration, the impetus for your spin cycle.
That was kind of going back to the roots, getting bluesy, and then getting lost in some craziness, trying to make it work, being too hectic to have it together. Just
there
trying
some clammage.
Yeah, a little clammage.
A little bit of clammage.
Been a while.
Okay, back to our guest, Nicole.
Welcome back, Nicole.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And your actress, we were last with you in your actress phase.
And then there was an acting
returning
school.
Returning back to SoCal.
Yeah. And then I went away. I ran off with the rock star. I came back after 5 years, spent a year in India. So I got my adventure in.
Yeah. England and India.
In India, yeah. I want to go back.
Not in England?
Any tips for people heading to India?
Go. Just go.
Just go and figure
yeah,
it out.
Yeah, just go and let serendipity be your guide. I was supposed to stay, 6 weeks. I stayed a year.
Yeah.
I just kept extending it.
What part?
Yeah. Everywhere north of Bombay, so I still have the south of the country. And I included Nepal.
Cool. You kept scattering it. Wasn't there attached to any particular guru?
No guru. In fact, I actually met some Tibetan Lama who had been a Lama since he was 3. The monks came and got him. And he looked at me and said, "Do you meditate?" And I looked at him. And he said, no, you're a teacher. And I said, no, I'm a waitress, because I was a waitress at that point. And he said, no, you're a teacher. And I'm like, whatever. And that was 1987. And 1995, I got invited to teach, and that was the start of my teaching career. So
you're teaching there?
No, here. I was invited to teach at CalArts after my first book of stories came out. Yeah. So.
Yeah, because that's an intense school.
It's a good school. The students are amazing.
It costs a little chinquando to go, right?
Yeah. Everywhere, though.
Watson told me about, Tom Watson, who plays guitar, my missing man, told me about going there a semester or something. And he had to be, like, conked in his VW bus there. It cost him so much he had to quit.
They used to do that, yeah.
They went to some crazy naked parties up there. That was really fun.
When I first started teaching there, there were lots of crazy naked parties, but not anymore.
Oh, shucks.
They clamped down on that.
Darn.
Yeah. Sadly, those are a thing of the past. But everywhere's a lot of dough to go. State schools. I went to UCLA.
I know,
where
I,
it keeps where getting I more expensive, yeah. too.
No, Morikano even was the Cal States. They were like $80 a semester.
Yeah, they really reamed those kids.
They were $80 a semester.
Yeah,
it was when I went, that is a con. When I went to UCLA.
Well, Harbor, the junior, I think, was 12.
Yeah, it was 11 bucks this when is, I was going there.
This is like
$11 a unit.
When I went to UCLA, it was
$500
a year.
The whole fucking dealio.
Mm.
Yeah, at UCLA, it was $500 a year when I went.
Yeah.
And I don't have student loans. My students.
They're in debt up to their year.
They're going to be paying student loans when they're my age.
Yeah, man, it's like eternal slavery.
Yeah.
Just graduating from education.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you were invited. But did you ever have an idea that you were going to want to do this?
No, I didn't think I was a noble enough.
But you made
a
group
person.
Of stories? You didn't tell me about the writing.
Yeah, I have a book out. I have two books out of stories.
No, but back then, they got
back
you
then.
This thing.
Yeah, two books of stories.
How'd that happen?
I just
started. Punk rock stories?
No, some of them were. Short stories. I was Xeroxing my own and binding books and selling them at local bookstores. And then this guy started a small press, and he asked if I wanted him to publish a book of stories, and I did. Yeah. And it got picked up and reviewed nationally. And then I was on Fresh Air, which is a nationally broadcast
NPR
show. And so...
CalArts hears about this.
CalArts hears about this.
I didn't know that's how they picked up teachers.
Did you bring any samples with you?
No, I didn't. They called me. The dean of the department called me at 12 midnight and was like, have you ever thought about teaching?
Yeah.
It was like the day after my Fresh Air thing aired.
Oh, so he must have heard the show.
He must have heard the show. And he needed a teacher pronto because someone had a nervous breakdown, you know. College teachers are very delicate.
And maybe you get more options awaiting after they hear the show.
Well, you know, I think it's time for a little mix-up in my career thing. So.
Shuffle the deck.
Here, we are at the end of the second hour, December 10th, 2011 edition of Watt Beto Show. With our guest, Nicole Panner. Hold tight for hour three. December 10th, 2011, it's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro Show.
Well, some people like my music. Still, I can't get a gig.
Talking, give you the death penalty for jaywalking, for the pettiest of crimes. He'll show you no pity. He's gonna send everybody to Tent City. His name's Torpio, 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 Torpio. His name is Torpio, Torpio. Hey kids, do drugs. Do time, go to Tent City, they'll teach you how to do crime. You're gonna socialize with criminals for a couple of days. They'll teach you all their deviant ways. Fill that mind with unlawful knowledge. Welcome to Torpio's Criminal College. It's the Torpio, Torpio, Torpio Criminal College. And while you're behind our bio's bars, they're gonna teach you how to steal my car and how to build a meth lab and how to kill. Joe's gonna pay your tuition bill. You know that you drink you. I managed to be a wrist slapper. Now you're shacking up with some Al Qaeda kidnapper. And he's teaching you how to make IDs that are phony and how to get high off green baloney and stuff. Torpio, 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 Torpio. But Joey's gonna change you up. So when you're released, go in a citizen, come out a beast. Thank you, Joe. I changed my ways. You turned me to Charlie Manson in just 20 days. Dunk a shame, Torpio, 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 Torpio. So don't mess up or look too Mexican, no matter what you do. For Sheriff Joe, he'll get medieval on you too. He's got his own horse, he's got his own posse. Whoopsie, Arizona. You elected a Nazi.
Big punk rock in Israel. One, two, one, two, three, one. Thank you, Joe, our boy.
you, thinking you are royal. Leave us all alone.
We'll be right back.
Speedway King by Dirty Beaches.
Speaking of Adolf being a Speedway King.
Hijacked the radio by the Nerve Breakers. You remember them? They opened for the Sex Pistols in Dallas. You probably weren't in
Dallas. I did go to the San Francisco show.
I remember it was really rainy. Did you leave that night? Or were you there ahead of time?
I was there ahead of time.
Because I wanted to drive up there and see it too, but it was raining like a sieve.
Down here? Yeah, no, I had been up there.
Okay.
I was know ready Helen to go. Was there. Helen was there.
Helen's got a great story.
Yeah, it's where she and Sid.
Then we had Thank You Joe Arpaio from Paige the Village Idiot. Then Angry Samoans, your buddy Greg
My good friend Greg Turner.
Uh-huh. He was on that VOM record.
He was on that VOM record, yeah. And he is...
This is when he was in Angry Samoans, and it's called They Saved Hitler's Cock.
They Saved Hitler's Cock.
Yes.
The Gummy Stumps, The Girl That Nature Ate. Gummy Stumps, I got to, they opened up for me in October in Glasgow, a great band.
Salute the Stumps.
Stumps.
Yeah, nubby.
Gummy. Yeah. That was a great gig. Their trip, this cat was playing, they were a three-piece. One man had a music stand and did the words and the drummy. And then this cat who played a guitar that had one bass string and two guitar strings.
Wow.
He was like kind of the string section of the group. They were great.
Trippy.
They were great. So, you get hired to do teaching because of some... thing you've written, but now it's worked out to the schooling is now around film.
Yeah.
Now, how'd that happen? Because of this.
Well, I was teaching.
Actressing thing yet?
No, I'd also been for my straight job working for a man named Frank Pearson. I did development for him for his very small company, which meant that I read scripts that people wanted to sell him that he was considering buying. I also, he did a lot of work with me with his own work.
So scripts, in a way, is writing for movies.
It is writing for movies.
This is exactly the structure to make it happen.
And Frank had written Cool Hand Luke and Dog Day Afternoon and... He was,
but he's looking for other people.
Because he was also a director at this point. Okay. Yeah. So I worked with, and he also would get big fat writing gigs, and he would bounce stuff off of me because he said I had the best global view for story that he'd ever run into in all his years of showbiz, which gave me a lot of confidence. He was kind of like the dad person I hadn't ever had.
Philip K. Dick was the first.
Well, I obviously my life is kind of a series of that, isn't it?
Walter Kent. Back to the CalArts man.
Yeah.
Because he's hired you because of the book, but he starts being aware of your movie connection.
Well, no. No. He was the head of one department, and yeah. I looked at the movie department and realized they didn't have a screenwriting thing.
Well, they were hurting. Okay.
Well, they weren't. They didn't think they were. The head of it was this German guy who didn't believe in screenwriting.
Yeah, those Germans.
Yeah.
Just everything's improvised?
No, everything's the director. You tell me how that works.
Oh, you mean he writes a script too, the director?
According to this guy, yeah. But the students really wanted screenwriting, and they knew my background. They knew that I was working for Frank. Because I would also bring movie friends in. That class I taught, the writing class, was called FTW DIY, and the kids called it punk writing.
Yeah.
And I would bring people in who were do-it-yourselfers. I brought in my friend James Marandino, who did a film called SLC Punk.
Yeah.
You know, I brought in a lot of movie people.
I saw that movie. It was trippy.
Good movie about punk.
Okay, let's play some more music.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4. Down to Seven Seas of Love. Red, black, brown, beige, Caribbean, Adriatic, vagina. The Seven Seas of Love. Two. Red, black, beef, pork, pudding, fundament, wee-wee. Three. Black, brown, bran, wheat, cunny, butt, mucilage. Four. Menstrual, vino, saliva, sweat, hot and sour. C number six. Napalm. 5. Rojo, Verde, Vegan, Bako, Butto, Mush Pie, Tequila. 6. Dead, Med, Lava Lamp, Mackerel, Snapper, Ammonia, Velveeta. 7. Latex, cleavage, tum water, clit water, bath water, fart water, heroin. 8. Salt, no salt, scum, sand, snot, yeast, patchouli. 9. KY, K9, BJ, JO, estrogen, nitrogen, enema.
Sorry to interrupt Nicole's non-windbagging.
Thank you.
With some music. But I wanted to hear this stuff. We heard Unwell by Allie Kohler. I think she was just kicked out of her band.
Oh.
what's it called? Coast. West Coast. Something like that. Best Coast. Yeah. So that's fucked up. Sorry, Allie.
Dave Nabbit.
And then after that, Lonely Lady by Death Songs. And then I'm in Love with Your Mom by Vaughn with Richard Meltzer singing and Greg Turner.
And Greg Turner playing.
Because I knew about this connection. So I Because last time I played this song was 8 years ago, Brother Matt. I looked it up.
Uh-huh. The stuff that Greg's working on now is great.
I look forward to hearing
Blood
that.
Drain I don't know if it's a Blood Drain Cows record, but...
I remember I played some of that stuff.
Yeah.
That was a few years ago, though.
His guy on a guitar thing is so great.
Respect to Greg Turner.
It's too much.
Yeah.
And then finally we heard Spielgusher. The album comes out in a month. It's Richard Meltzer again, but this time with me and two people from Tokyo, Shuga, Mr. Shimi, and the Seven Seas of Love. Do you know about this project?
No.
Richard gave me 48 poems he made.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke them in Portland. He's lived in Portland now for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And recorded them on a bunch of Mondays in 2004, and I finally found some people who would help me make music behind it. In 3 days, we did 65 pieces of music.
Wow.
And put them together, and it's going to come out in January.
Wow.
And, Richard said it sounded, we made it more kinder. He was really surprised when he heard it, because he thought it was kind of angry, his poems. Actually, some of them were ones, you know, he was going to do a collaboration with the Minutemen. In fact, I took D. Boone the 10 lyrics to him on the trip where he got killed with a van wrecked. And Richard wanted to play saxophone and sing with us.
I bet he did.
We got to do it, but the poems have seen the light of day now, plus, you know, 35 other ones. How many years later? Yeah. Ain't that a trip? But he said it... It really made me happy to know he was happy. I was kind of scared. You don't know, you know. You do these kind of collaborations like this. I've done a lot of them now because of the internet. Sometimes you never even meet the people. Like Richard was a big hero in a big Eagle and Mirror Boys. And so it's a trippy kind of thing all coming around. Now, back to your story. You design this class for CalArts.
Yeah.
This one doesn't exist.
Good job.
And you bring people who have done things themselves.
Yeah, I have.
As like a show and tell or something.
Everybody from Black Dahlia to Mr. Winkle.
You brought me.
I brought you, that's right. I did. Me. And Dave Alvin.
And I was scared shitless.
You were.
But those kids
were
great. They're beautiful.
Fabulous.
Makes education real. Get the real deal out.
You know this cat, Robert Ashley?
No.
Good, you're going to like this. This is a piece he made. In fact, this guy who's on piano was he was one of the Stooges piano players.
Mm.
And then he went and changed his name to Blue Jean Tyranny and ended up doing music to this guy. This is a piece called The Park.
Mm-hmm.
He took himself seriously. Motel rooms had lost their punch for him. He opened all his bags. There were two, and inside those two, there were two more. It's not an easy situation. But there was something like abandon in the air. There was something like the feeling of the idea of silk scarves in the air. There was a kind of madness to it, the kind we read about in magazines. One of the bags contained a bottle of liquor, a sure sign of thoughtfulness about who one might have been. He poured himself a small drink in the fluted plastic glass sans ice. he thought to himself, if I were from the big town, I would be calm and debonair. The big town doesn't send its riffraff out. He sat on the bed, both feet on the floor. He studied the ashtray and tried to rule out preference, preferring over not preferring it. But he preferred gravity over whatever state, preferring in that case earth, the earth as they say, preferring some state over non-state. Now he grips himself with determination, even knowing that it causes sadness. He is determined to be what? He is determined to be serious. He had determined once to be serious. Later he knew that he had made a mistake, but too late he had arrived, and there were rooms, and all rooms were not the same. Some better than others, he thought. A better view, a better layout, better shower, softer bed, not so far from noise, more like home, etc., etc. Very abstract. He lifted the telephone from its cradle. His determination got stronger, if no clearer, even as he fainted in its force. Were it not for our momentum, the inertia of our actions, the constant inspiration of our habits, we could not continue. The will is almost nothing, he thought to himself. At the sound of the first ring, he hung up. He pushed down the button and listened to the silence of the object in his hand, and then he hung up. Very dramatic. The phone rang immediately. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. He brings this cloud of conditions with him. He is at the center of a ball of hot stuff that we haven't put our minds to yet. And sitting on the bed in the motel room is no different. Somewhere in another room in range, somebody got it and phoned him. It happens all the time. Really. A kind of restlessness in that range. He sat and thought about obedience. He had resolved that of the two kinds, the kind that takes every message of order, rule, law, as error, that everybody who passes along these messages, that loathes the buildings, that contradicts the inner voice, that resists, in short, was his, and that the other kind, how could it be? He wasn't happy with the world. He worked with the forwardness and the backwardness. He worked with what things are ahead of us and with what things are behind us. I guess the other kind would be to work with things that are alongside, the attachments. Obedience was impossible for him. At the same time, he was cooperative and indeed solicitous. No one in the world would have mistaken him for a real person. Obedience, etc. The other kind works with the things that are alongside us, the attachments. At the same time, he was cooperative. The numbers on the telephone, the parts of the book, the notes of the scale, they are the same, are they not? They come from the sameness of the idea of the outsideness, not the alongside the outsideness, the differentness. It was a problem, being cooperative and at the same time refusing obedience and carrying the load of the idea of differentness. He wants. He handles himself in the morning. It's just like for every other man. The fantasy is the distance, the reluctance, the reticence, the otherness. The fantasy is the uncleanness. So getting up gets to be a problem for a sensitive person like him. The problem is to run that gauntlet again. Remove problem. Remove gauntlet. Remove run. Remove is to. Remove the. Remove that. Leave this. Make this whatever. He lights the motel room with a slightly blue body light. When he is alone, he forgets sometimes to walk. He just moves. Sometimes they touch, sometimes they don't, and everything in between. As sometimes he forgets to combine talk with thinking, and just thinks, or just talks. Especially, I think, it happens in those rooms, who knows why. The way it disconnects from what's just outside is predictable, is it not so? It never stops being a mystery. We have talked about it. When he says hello, you hear a long whining sound, which is his voice and the hello. It is as different from whatever, a way one might remember, as a sound a cat would make. He is not unusual in this, I think. He is absolutely uninhabitable. A thankless star. Remove star. Remove thankless. Remove A. Replace with. He has a special way of speaking, but it seems only to make him more like other men. This is one place, and here every kid is armed. So where you going? Hunting. Only sometimes we don't see the guns. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. The town and always references to down and up. Down from Des Moines, up from somewhere. Missed my chance, didn't even see it. Thought it was a threat to house and home. Why don't you come up to the big town? No thanks. Looking back. Didn't get the up and down part. How could I have missed it? Get a grip on yourself, he said. Working against time was another thing he said. Here I am working against time. The pencil fairly flew as he made out his simple requests for breakfast. Room service, courtesy of the company. This is a record. I am sitting on a bench next to myself. Inside of me, the words form. Come down out of the tree and fight like a man. Two G's and eggs. This is not a record. This is a story. I want to say something about myself. I am not sitting on a bench next to myself, whatever that means. I am a city of habits. I am completely knowable in every way. I recognize superstition in every form. The anger of the words wakes me in the dream of myself. I imagine there are two men on the bench. The exchange between them will not be seen. They will not put it forth to be seen. And if I make something of the situation to show a difference between the two men, the difference will distract the true onlooker. But the film fogs, you know. 1G in fogs. And add a dish of prunes if they are in season. The men are in the park in the small Midwestern town. That is, the bench is in the park. We know from what is past that the men are on the bench. They are old by doctor's standards. The park graces the courthouse of the county. The courthouse has about it the simple air of failure. An abandoned outpost. The park has sidewalks, fences, trees, grass, and a statue of a man and a horse at war. Or ready for war. They are alone with their intentions. The sculptor has made the horse look stupid. The man's jaw is firm. The time is late morning and early summer. The sun shines. In this scene, there are two shots. The park and all its details, frozen, broken on the right edge, sometimes up to two-thirds across the frame, by the body of a person, very close, blurred, moving almost rhythmically. We have just begun and already we are stuck, working against time, as they say. The camera is obsessed with what it sees, the park, the ragged edge. Nothing moves except the edge. The edge moves. It's as if there is no other place. His mind races. 1G in fogs. 2Gs in eggs. When the two men spoke, they spoke about permanence and impermanence. They noted that there were certain things which were impermanent, and other things to which the term impermanence did not apply. Thus they came to make a great division between that which is impermanent and that which is permanent. Everything in this transitory category turned out to be the particulars of our existence, and these were divided into physical, mental, and others which were neither physical nor mental. Among those particulars which were neither physical nor mental, they listed attainment, aging, and coincidence. On the permanent side of this great division of reality was a notion they referred to as space. And by that term, they meant neither conceptual space nor space as given by our senses. They meant connections. they decided that such space is irreducible and not transitory, and that it exists as long as one is alive. They wondered, naturally, what becomes of it. This impasse is no help at all. Consider his situation. For instance, he is expected to be positive and helpful about breakfast. In the order of things, it is more important that she know about the prunes than that the shot should change. And what about the problems we have seen in him? He is still sitting on the bed, both feet on the floor. The small drink in the fluted plastic glass sans ice is hardly touched. The phone has just stopped ringing. In his mind, the two men are frozen on the bench. The horse looks stupid. The warrior's jaw is firm. Incredibly slowly, our view begins to slide. His idea is that death always takes one by surprise. Always. There is no way to prepare. He imagines absolute awareness on the other side. He wonders, as we all do, how it comes to you that you are dead. We were distracted by the fluid right edge. There is an absoluteness to surprise, he thinks. He applies this simple thought to the problem of how to move the shot. Incredibly slowly, our view begins to slide. That begins as a problem. We are enchanted by the park and all its details, frozen, broken on the right edge by the body of the person very close, blurred, moving rhythmically. How can it begin to change? How can the beginning go unnoticed? How can we pass from one state to another? Is it possible, if one already has a certain experience of life, to start directly on the path? Or is there danger involved in trying to do advanced practices without having the proper foundation? They came to believe that unless one has actually gone through the preliminary experiences, conclusions may be drawn on the basis of insufficient information, and that these conclusions may produce just the opposite effect of the one which is intended. In other words, one never knows. And so the view begins to slide anyway, as they say, sliding eastward, turning eastward. The particulars moving left to right across the frame. A parade of sorts. And it comes to rest, finally, on the road, the street that holds the park. We are still obsessed. We are not relieved. This view is no different. How could it be? Except that we have moved off the body of the person, very close and blurred, and every edge is raw. And there is some machine approaching, wider than it is high, as they say. A pack of motorcycles, a herd of elephants, a tribe of Bedouins, something from the east, barely moving in a cloud of haze and heat and dust, in utmost telephoto, gold and green and flat. The idea of the slit, the eye of the needle,
What for Pedro show? That was The Park from Robert Ashley. Nicole, so what's next for you?
Well, the world is in kind of a weird place, our world.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I'm a little unsure of that. I have another book to write. I'd like to get married again, I'm thinking, to somebody who can grow a garden and hunt, and I can shoot stuff. I'm a good shot. Build shelter and stuff like that. Sustaining, yeah. I don't know. There is, I do feel like I'm at sort of a personal crossroads.
You want to quit teaching?
I think I can never quit teaching. I'll always be a teacher, like that Buddhist monk told me I was.
Yeah.
I think that's an incarnation thing. I can't escape that. And I've taught like 3 generations already. At 17 years, it feels like it's been a lot. But they keep coming back and telling me that I really helped them. So
you don't want to quit.
You don't want to quit.
Okay.
But there's other forums. I mean, I helping people to articulate their story is a really cool thing to do.
Mm.
It's a really, because it helps them make sense of their lives. And if you've made some kind of sense and created a narrative, it seems to ease the pain of, like, being human, you know? And I think that's important. But in terms of my own life, I think I'd like to be less hermity. I'm kind of a hermit. 'Cause I live, you know, a life of the mind often. But I also, I mean, I don't know. I do yoga every day for an hour.
Any more India trips?
I'd like to go to India. I'd like to go so many places. I went to Central America 3 years ago for 4 months, and we worked our way up from Nicaragua to the U.S. border by bus.
Wow.
Because I wanted to see what that journey was like, because so many people make that journey,
right,
and they make it in different ways. And I did that with my significant other, who's since passed away, and that was a really profound experience, that trip. Seeing the hardship people go through to make that journey. I'd like to go back to India. I would like, I've been photographing stuff for the last few years, and I've had a few shows of photographs. So I'm finally kind of over the sense of insecurity of myself as an artist. Crippling insecurity. One always has insecurity about themselves as an artist. But I don't allow my insecurity to stop me from doing it now, which during the flowering of punk rock, I really did. I was too convinced that I had nothing to bring to the table. I know now that that's not the case. I do have something to bring to the table.
Thank you for bringing yourself to the show.
Right on, front row seat at the table, Nicole.
Thanks for asking.
It's been the December 10th, 2011 Watt for Pedro show. Brother Matt, thank you for your always essential
right
in my bed. Skipper Jeff, thanks for tying up.
Thanks for letting me drop anchor.
Ernie, catching the tail end, Ernie.
Making sure that chair don't blow away.
Yeah.
Good job, brother.
Here I'm going.
Nicole, thanks for being here.
Everybody keep your powder dry.